Lord, I ask that you would speak to us today. I also ask that we would lift our hearts and our minds up to you in terms of the glory of what you do in this world as well. In Jesus' name, amen. This Thursday is our national holiday known as Thanksgiving. So today, as we go through this week of Thanksgiving, I want to talk about our national holiday and a little bit of what I see as the reason for giving thanks. I once read a little anecdote about this holiday that says Thanksgiving is not the only day that people don't give thanks. And what a terrible thing to say, but you know, it's the truth. Thanksgiving is not the only day that we don't give thanks. The truth is, we don't give thanks nearly as often as we should. We don't think about things. So I want to go at this message a couple of two different ways today. The first is the traditional way. I want to look at that first Thanksgiving day, and then we'll look at my weird way of looking at it as well. First, the traditional Thanksgiving message. It goes something like this. Imagine the scene. We're someplace in the rock-ribbed coast of Massachusetts, and the bare and bended arm of New England, and the white coast of Plymouth, and there were this group of religious refugees who landed there about 400 years ago, 1620 actually. They were blown off course. They thought they had landed in Virginia, but they were on that unfriendly coast up there in Massachusetts area. And we need to feel the anguish of these people in the next 5 months. Over half of the 101 settlers were in their graves. They had died during the unspeakable hardships and famine and disease in that first winter. And their graves were left unmarked because the settlers didn't want the Indians to know how many of them had actually died. In the spring, when the Mayflower set sail again back to the comfort of England and home, not one of the survivors chickened out and went back with the ship. They were obviously courageous people, and I can tell you of their devotion and their determination, which are written in the Mayflower Compact, which has become the life and breath of a great nation. Now, I guess I could dwell for a few minutes on our national heritage and how we should all congratulate ourselves that we were smart enough to be born Americans. But maybe that doesn't quite ring true, you know. I don't know about you, but I didn't really pick the spot. Somehow we were chosen to be the people who are born in this country as opposed to, say, Rwanda or some other place in this world like Bangladesh. Anyway, these settlers went through another summer of indescribable hardship, and as they were led by Elder Brewster through the cornfields of Plymouth, and they raised their voices in the ancient song of the psalmist, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, there the world and they that dwell therein." I guess I could speak to you about the wonderful sense of gratitude in these early settlers in this country. Now, in order for me to make a traditional sermon like this, I really need to make the message also timely, contemporary, and, of course, relevant. We ministers are always under a great burden to make our messages on Sunday morning relevant. And so I would quickly jump back and forth between the last 400 years and I could establish my theme for the message, which goes something like this. If the poor pilgrims could be thankful for just hanging on to dear life, then we ought to be thankful for the affluent American way of life that they founded for us. Then I would search the newspapers and the magazines and get some choice examples for that which we should be thankful. And I can always go to the magazine section of the newspaper where we will be told that we should certainly be thankful for the fact that at the turn of the 20th century, which was 1900s, only a very wealthy family in America could ever even afford a turkey for Thanksgiving because it cost about 30 gold dollars back then. And I believe that right now at some of our local grocery stores, you can get this stuff oven-ready, corn-fed, vitamins-added, self-basting, double-breasted turkeys for about, well, less than a dollar. or some price like that. Or I could say that those of us here today who are over 65 years old, that we should be thankful that we can even celebrate Thanksgiving this year. Because 75 years ago, our life expectancy would have been about 43 years. And most of us wouldn't be even around to eat the turkey if it wasn't for the discovery of penicillin. And I guess I can tell you what other people have been thankful for on Thanksgiving, like TV stations and newspapers do when they interview people about things. One wife was thankful for the fact that this year she had a real roaster in which to do her bird after 22 years of doing it in a cake pan and having to clean up the oven afterwards. Another lady was thankful for the nice weather that we're having, but she was also glad that we'd had one hard freeze so that it killed all the flowers outside so that she could go buy chrysanthemums and at the florist for her table without feeling guilty. One grandmother was thankful for the fact that turkeys are all plucked and clean shaven, because in her day she had to pick out all those pin feathers. And one career girl was happy because the high boots that are fashionable keep her feet warm, and the bulky knit warm sweaters keep her top warm, and the pantyhose make her knees look good. One career lady was thankful for her pantsuits so she could sit without worrying about what she was showing. Another was thankful for the pebble pattern floor tile that they now had in their house, that it didn't show the dirty marks of little feet. Another mother was thankful for the fact that they now had protective spray for their upholstery and stain-resistant carpet for clothes and upholstery, and because they could eat their meals in front of the TV and set their DVR so they could record the program so they could get rid of all the commercials. And if you were to ask one minister, a local minister here in town, he would say, I give thanks for DVRs and recorded football games like the 1985 Super Bowl Bears, which can be trotted out immediately following the Bears-Lions game this year on Thursday on Thanksgiving. I could also end up with a couple of blockbuster things, like the fact that the American car manufacturers now compete very well with Japanese and Koreans and all these other foreign-made cars, and they get decent mileage. They don't always fall apart as easily as they used to. It's a reason to give thanks. Besides, when you eat on Thursday, remember that the ration for the pilgrims in their first dread winter in Plymouth was only about 5 grains of corn per meal, and at least $1 billion corn crop was harvested in the state of Illinois alone this year. Point made, message is clinched, the sermon is over. Now go home and be thankful this week, at least on Thanksgiving Day, or shame on you. Now that could be what is said in the American church this week. At least that's the pattern. And I'd get somebody else to come up here and preach this sermon. The outcome of Thanksgiving sermon is pretty much the outcome of most sermons that deal with giving thanks. If you are thankful, you don't need a sermon. And if you're not thankful, no sermon is going to convince you. And I thought about this the last few days as we were out there. So let me give you a Thanksgiving message that I have been thinking about, and it really concerns our home state of Illinois more than anything else. And when I was in seminary preparing to be a pastor, I'd like for us to read together Psalm 115, verses 1 to 8, which you have in your bulletin. And let us read that together. Here we go. Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to thy name give glory for the sake of thy steadfast love and thy faithfulness. Why should the nations say, where is their God? Our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. Those who make them are like them, so are all who trust in them. And he's comparing what is out there to what we do. When I was in seminary preparing to be a pastor in my first year of seminary back in 1969, I would drive from Louisville, Kentucky to Bloomington, Illinois every couple of weeks to see Berta. Love drives you. Anyway, as I thought about this message, I thought about that when I would drive from Louisville, Kentucky to Bloomington, Illinois, and I also thought about my drive from just Decatur to Bloomington to get on the plane to fly to Boston, Massachusetts in September, and then in October as we were starting the great banquet out there in Boston. And as I drove the road between Decatur and Bloomington, I had enough time to think about what was going on, and I thought about the people out there in Boston, and those people, a lot of them, when I talked to them, they're kind of awed by the flatness of the land in Illinois, Indiana, Western Ohio, and also how black the soil is and stuff like that. And I remembered a couple of them actually saying that they couldn't understand how anyone in their right mind would want to live there because there's nothing to see for hundreds of miles but flats, black soil, or crops like soybeans and corn. And I was thinking to myself while I was out there, I don't know why anybody would want to live out here in Boston where it takes 2.5 hours just to drive 10 miles. Because the traffic's terrible out there. But, you know, there is something to see here in Illinois, and as well as Indiana, Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Western Ohio. In the fall, it's corn. Fields and fields of corn, acres and acres of corn, miles and miles of corn, and the wonder of it, the sheer, unspeakable, unbelievable wonder of all those fields filled with corn and soybeans that stretch all around us as far as the eye can see. And the thing is, as many times as I've seen those many fields of corn, that sea of grain over the years, I also realize that it stretches for hundreds of miles in every direction. The sheer weight and bulk of the miracle has been before my eyes so many times for so many years. And as I just drove to Bloomington, the sea of grain went with me all the way. And somehow, if I could just catch the wonder of that miracle that I have seen and convey it to you, it would make the miraculous feeding of the 5,000 look like a nice light afternoon tea. The simple fact that is that in about 130 days, those fields have gone from black barren soil to all the fruitful grain, and it does it every year. And I remember one time when I was about 11 or 12 years old on my own grandfather's farm where I had nothing to do. And so I picked up an ear of corn and I counted the kernels on that corn. I got one right here. Now, this is a different kind of corn. I don't know what this is. I'd like to see the ear that came off of. But that's beside the point. When I was 11 or 12, I counted them. And there was someplace between 700 or 800 kernels of corn on that one ear of corn. And this corn right here, it's good old Illinois corn. Actually, it came out of a field right near here. And I sort of counted it, too. But, you know, I lived in Kentucky for 23 years. And down there, I would get their corn out of their fields and they're about 100 kernels less than Illinois corn. So I figured something out. We have bigger ears than people in Kentucky. But anyway, just around here, and on my the old Pitzer farm up near Cooksville, Illinois, there's about 700 to 800 kernels of corn per ear. You who have ears to hear, may you hear. You know, the Bible talks about harvesting grain 100-fold. And there were over 800 kernels of corn on that one I counted some 50-some years ago. One seed of corn had produced itself not 100-fold, but over 800 times. What about the rest of it? The root, the stalk, the leaves, the tassel? One fertilizer salesman had said that in the fodder alone, there is, on an average cornfield, 3,000 pounds of fodder per acre. Boiling that down to its simplest terms, on an average farm of 300 acres of corn, there would be 1 million pounds of food and other valuable materials that had not been there 18 weeks earlier. 1 million pounds had not been there just a few weeks earlier. Now you got to think about the earth-shaking wonder of it all. And if we do begin to think about that, then we wouldn't for 1 minute listen to some supposedly intelligent scholar or scientist. And I grew up and I went to college and I graduated in chemistry and physics, so I know about these people who will stand up on their pipsqueak legs and tell us with pompous nobility that this whole thing is a combination of the accidental evolution of an accidental universe assisted by the technological skills and scientific advances of an accidentally evolving human mind. You will instead see them for the eloquent, if articulate, fools that they really are. Read with me Psalm 14, verses 1 and 2. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, they do abominable deeds, there is none that does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any that act wisely, that seek after the God. They are fools, even though they may be smart. If a person inspired by this 1 million pounds of foodstuff, inspired by the goodness of God at this miracle, is hopelessly naive, then that person who doesn't see this as a miracle, as a miracle of the grace of God, no matter how sophisticatedly brilliant he might be, is blind and a fool, and an idiot for that matter. They are, you know. We take them so seriously as though their word were law. You see, science has become the religion of the day. And it is a religion. And science, though, tells us this. Science tells us how things work. But science does not tell us why we are. Science tells us how things work. But when you look in the mirror, science does not tell you why you are. And it really doesn't matter how many degrees they print after their names. They are ignorant. They are blind, mainly by the religion of science. They are blinded. And it's about time we woke up to that fact. You see, what we lost and are losing is the sheer wonder of God's grace in our lives. Again and again in the gospel narratives, that word is used to describe the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. They wondered at what they saw. They wondered at his words. They were filled with wonder at his presence. Thanksgiving and giving thanks is not and never can be strained, contrived. It is actually comes out of the heart, and it is a joyful explosion. It's a shout of wonder at the grace of God that is out there and in here. You see that a lot of our problem is that we just don't see it anymore. Today we have miracles on every street corner, in every kitchen, in every factory, in every garage. We are blasé and jaded and bored by the miracles that are around us. We have lost our wonder at them. We take so much for granted. We take God for granted. We take our blessings for granted. We take the people that are precious to us for granted. We take our own lives for granted. And we're bored with the wonder of it all. And how can a bored heart ever flow with spontaneous joy? Isn't it rather strange that in an age of wonder, we have lost our capacity to just wonder? How long has it been since you were filled with awe at some mystery of this world? Wonderful is the most overworked word in our vocabulary. It falls from almost every lips, before every situation, on every subject, until it really has a hollow ring to it of insincerity. You know, obviously, if everything is wonderful, then nothing is wonderful. And we need to remember, at a tender age, our children learn the trick of affecting the bored sophistication about everything that is out there. Oh, it's all quite wonderful, but they aren't impressed. And all they reflect is us older kids in a lot of ways, and we're not impressed either. How many in variations of the intelligent dog story have you heard? The one where the stranger walks into the village store and sees a man and a large dog seated at a table playing checkers, and the stranger watches in stunned fascination as while the dog with keen skill and cunning strategy beats his human opponent and wins the checker game. Finally, the stranger blurts out, "That's wonderful." And the man replies, "What's so wonderful about it? I beat him 2 out of 3 games. How many variations on that story do we have that point out the fact that nothing is miraculous, that nothing is wonderful? On Thursday, when the Bears beat the Lions, Bear fans will say, "Isn't that wonderful?" And all the other people will say, "What's so wonderful? The Lions are 3-7. You see, we're not moved by anything, but have you forgotten how bad the Bears have been? We are such a dull people. Bored, unmoved, unexcited, boring. And that's the heart of our society. And a lot of, we bore each other. We no longer have cause for song. Life is just an old chorus, an overplayed, scratchy record, monotonous and repetitious. Long ago, we lost our first wild, careless rapture at the sheer fact of living. Our pragmatic education in our days has its primary purpose, the equipping of a child with the skill necessary to cope with the pressing affairs of a practical age. Knowledge is a tool for manufacturing dollars. And that's important, isn't it? We teach good, solid, practical subjects like how to park a car properly or how to make it do it yourself repairs on a garbage disposal or something like that. And we forget about the beauty, the joy, the awe of what we see around us. We don't get paid for those, do we? So what good are they? A rose is not a crimson petal upon which the drops of clear morning dew reflect the blue of the sky. A rose is a rose that is botanically related to the wild briar. And we've got answers for everything. Read with me Psalm 65, verses 9 to 13. Here we go. Thou visitest the earth and waters it. Thou greatly enrichest it. The rivers of God is full of water. Thou provides their grain, so you have prepared it. You watered its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers, and blessing its growth. Thou crownest the year with thy bounty. The tracks of your chariot drip with fatness. The pastures of the wilderness drip. The hills gird themselves with joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valley decks themselves with grain. They shout and sing together for joy. They shout and sing together for joy. That's Thanksgiving. May you feel it this week as we as a nation lift our eyes to our Maker for just a brief moment. I'd like for us to stand and read Psalm 95 verses 1 to 7 as our closing, as we get ready to have our closing song. Here we go. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it. For his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Oh, that today you would hearken to his voice.